Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. According to a new NPR poll, many Native Americans say they experience discrimination when they call the police or go to federal court.
They don't trust us and we don't trust them. That's just bottom line, but it shouldn't be that way.
We will look at how many in Wyoming are nervous about changes to the sage-grouse management plans and how others are relieved.
They think that they have a role that they can play if they're properly structured, but they simply went overboard.
And we'll talk about prison reform, humans and grizzly encounters, and a conversation with a state senator about getting more bang for our buck in education. It's coming your way on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Half of Native Americans living on Indian reservations say they or a family member feel they've been treated unfairly by the courts. That's according to a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. It's a lack of justice that Wind River Reservation residents say they live with every day. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, now the tribes are working together to solve that problem.
One morning, Northern Arapaho member Rose was sitting at the table with her 14-year-old daughter, Latoya.
I told her to move her hair because she had her hair like this.
Latoya hit her neck and cheek by pulling her hair in front.
Because I noticed something and she went like that and she had marks, hickeys, just completely covering her, almost even on her face.
That's when Latoya told her mother that she'd been forcibly kissed by a woman from another reservation who was 6 years older. Because they're afraid of retaliation, they asked we only use their middle names.
At that moment, I saw me and her, and there was just nothing I could do for her except let her know that it's not her fault. It's okay. I'll protect you.
Protect her, because when Rose herself was 6, she too was molested by an older girl. Studies show that 1 in 3 Native American women are sexually assaulted in their life, but Rose wanted to stop that cycle of abuse. According to the NPR poll, 36% of Native Americans living on reservations say they avoid calling the police because of a fear of discrimination. So Rose called tribal police, but they referred her to the FBI, since her tribe isn't qualified to handle felonies. But after an investigation, federal prosecutor Carrie Jacobson declined to pursue Latoya's case. Like most assaults, the case rested solely on the victim's testimony.
The only allegations involved the subject touching the minor's lips, neck, and upper chest, and the knee, and those areas do not fall within the definition of sexual contact.
Jacobson says she recognizes that testifying against a perpetrator can be traumatic, and that's why she leaves cases like this open as long as possible, in case a victim wants to tell more later. She says the problem is it's much harder to get convictions later. Jacobson says these are the majority of her cases.
When a victim gets to a place where he or she feels safe enough and emotionally stable enough to divulge what happened, we have no scientific evidence left. Those are very challenging.
Jacobson did not interview the alleged perpetrator or any witnesses. In fact, a recent Government Accountability Office report shows that federal courts declined to prosecute 67% of reservation sexual assault cases. And since Latoya's case was dropped, the tribal police have taken over. But unlike the feds, they moved forward, issuing a warrant for the subject's arrest. The problem is, the tribal court can only issue misdemeanors, less than a year in jail. Leslie Shakespeare is a councilman for the Eastern Shoshone, the other tribe on Wind River. He wants to use the recently passed federal legislation called the Tribal Law and Order Act to do more. That law grants tribes the power to give sentences up to 9 years and do it faster.
The wait is what really disenfranchises people. So when they see that process happening quicker, which doesn't always happen on the federal side, they feel like, justice is actually working.
The two tribes have an ancient history of conflict, but Shakespeare says the new law is motivating them to work together to create a stronger, unified court.
It cuts down on the repeat offenders. It cuts down on that cyclical nature of some of the crimes that are prevalent in some of the reservations. And the other part of it is the community also feels their voice is being heard.
Since the act was implemented, the Department of Justice has even reported that the rates of prosecutions are on a slight uptick. Navajo tribal member and Wyoming State Senator Afi Ellis worked to write a report for the act called A Roadmap for Making Native America Safer.
You know, we've experimented a lot with having a strong federal presence. We've experimented in some states with having an exclusive state presence. But we really haven't experimented or tried letting tribes work this out themselves.
Ellis says even though the act allows for longer sentences, there's still one issue to work out.
It costs money to keep your inmates in prison. And so that's, I know, another question that needs to be addressed before tribes can start going down this path is what are we going to do with these people if we put them through our justice system and find them to be guilty?
Eight other reservations have already been figuring those problems out as they adopt tribal law and order courts. Rose is hoping Wind River will be the ninth, so her daughter Latoya's alleged assailant will finally face real justice.
That's the whole thing. She's somewhere. And she's probably somewhere doing this to another 14-year-old.
The new court is scheduled to be up and running by early next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
A new report says Wyoming's prison system is growing, which is driving up costs, and the culprit is the lack of prison reform, a new legislation that could lead to more people being placed behind bars. And the ACLU of Wyoming has released a report called Bucking the Trend, How Wyoming Can Reverse Course Through Reduced Incarceration and Lowered Costs. State Policy Director Sabrina King says they've given the legislature some ideas.
There are more and more bills introduced every year that create new crimes, that increase penalties. When that is not joined with taking a look once in a while at what have we passed that maybe no longer needs to be on the books, what sentences are no longer serving their purpose, and what reforms can we put in place to really address over-incarceration. When that doesn't exist in equal measure, you end up in the situation that Wyoming is in, which is we have a lot of laws on the books that are putting a lot of people behind bars and putting people under probation and parole supervision. And the state, quite frankly, can't handle it anymore. It is not a sustainable system.
You know, I can remember the 90s when they passed a lot of drug bills and that type of legislation. And you thought, well, that's when they did most of this. But we've come to find out that even within the last 3 or 4 years, they've got a lot of these bills that have tacked on some penalties.
For folks to understand kind of the numbers that we're talking about, in the past 4 years alone, 70 pieces of legislation have passed that have either created a new crime or have increased a penalty. And some of those things do address issues that have come up that didn't exist 15, 20 years ago. So one example that we talk about in the report is computer extortion. What we run into, though, is we run into habits of punishment. So for certain crimes, we automatically set the maximum number of years at 10 years. In prison, and the maximum financial penalty at $10,000. It's kind of become the default in Wyoming. Instead of looking at what is actually a penalty that makes sense, what is an amount of money that makes sense?
Criminal justice reform has been talked about. There was even legislation here this past year that did not make it all the way through that would have addressed some of that. Why don't I ask you about one in particular, because it's very timely. There's a lawsuit on not having a women's boot camp in this state.
What exists in Wyoming is a boot camp program for youth offenders, so people who are, I believe, under 25, so they're under 25 or under 26. And it is a deterrence program. So instead of someone who has committed a crime going to prison for 6, 8, 10 years, instead they go to a boot camp program, which is really meant as a rehabilitation, as a way for people to address issues that maybe caused them to commit the crime in the first place, and then to get people back into their lives, working their jobs, supporting their families, rather than particularly for young people, sending them into the prison system, which really can be very damaging, especially at a young age. For whatever reason, despite the fact that the law does not say that the boot camp program is only for men, the boot camp program has only been for men since its inception. Women end up then behind bars for years instead of being able to go through a boot camp program, address some of the issues that maybe got them there in the first place, and to get back out to support their families. So frankly, if you're talking about people who have committed crimes where there isn't necessarily like someone who has been harmed, it's not a violent crime, locking these women away for 6, 8, 10 years takes them away from their family. It takes them away from their job. It takes them away from their ability to get themselves back on their feet. There's no reason that the state of Wyoming does not have a boot camp program for women other than that is the decision the Department of Corrections has made.
One of the things that really people have tried very hard to reform are the drug laws in this state. There aren't many people that want to vote for these bills.
Right. And ironically, our drug laws is actually one thing that we did not address directly in this report, in large part because it is incredibly complicated and there are a lot of different, there are just so many different avenues that we could go through in terms of drug reform. I think one thing that people really need to keep in mind is just the practicality of what our drug laws are doing. I mean, first off, they are always, and even in Wyoming and always will be, disproportionately affecting people of color. They disproportionately affect poor people. If we are looking at legislation, for example, that could make someone a felon for simply having a bag of gummy bears. I mean, this is the classic example, right? You have a young college kid who maybe isn't thinking about the long-term consequences of what they're doing, and suddenly they have a felony on their record for the rest of their life. We really need to be thinking hard about what that is doing to people and why we're doing it. I mean, if people are doing something that is being done on their own time, it's not affecting other people, that really should be taken into consideration. And that's something that I think is going to take time at the legislature, and it will probably take more efforts from people on the ground trying to get ballot initiatives passed to legalize marijuana. I think in Wyoming, that's going to be the only way that that's going to happen because the legislature certainly is not going to do it. But I think what the legislature does have the power to do is to really look at the laws that are in the books and that have been on the books for a long time, particularly as it relates to our drug laws, and just look at ways that we can maybe have some compassion and maybe have some practical thinking around who are we turning into a felon? Who are we convicting of misdemeanors and why? Are we doing it because we don't like what they're doing, or are we doing it because what they're doing is dangerous to society? And that's a really key question.
If people want to look at this report, where do they find it?
So if you go onto our website, which is aclu-wy.org, it's right there on the front page and you can find it.
Sabrina King of the Wyoming ACLU, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
When we come back, the congressional delegation talks climate change. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. This month, the federal government released a dire assessment of climate change that says human beings are likely the cause of the problem. But as Matt Laszlo explains, the report is not having an impact on Wyoming lawmakers or the Trump administration.
Every 4 years, the federal government is required to release a report on the world's changing climate, and this year's was the most comprehensive report since Congress mandated it. It states there's no convincing alternative explanation to climate change other than that humans are the cause. The report is the work of more than a dozen federal agencies, but Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse says the political appointees in the Trump administration have buried their heads in the tar sands.
This administration's industry hacks are not paying attention, and instead of helping, they're out busily doing things like deleting the words climate change from agency websites.
But when we caught up with Wyoming Senator John Barrasso and asked him about that report, he refused to comment on its content.
Well, I also saw the report that came out yesterday that said emissions from China are expected to go up and up and up, and emissions in the United States are going down and down and down. So we have done so much.
Barrasso is head of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. He recently held a hearing entitled Promoting American Leadership in Reducing Air Emissions Through Innovation, where he tried to steer clear of climate change.
The development of innovative drilling methods has allowed domestic oil and gas producers to economically access natural gas, a low-emitting fuel. Development of new technologies has consistently reduced our emissions, grown our energy, and improved how we use our resources.
leaders from around the globe are meeting in Bonn, Germany to discuss the Paris Climate Accord. President Trump sent just 48 representatives, which is far fewer than President Obama used to send. But American governors, mayors, university scientists, and major corporations attended to try to signal that the U.S. isn't sitting on the sidelines, even if Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord. But now that Syria has joined the accord, Democrats, like Virginia Congressman Jerry Connolly, say the U.S. is making itself irrelevant as the only U.N. member trying to pull out of the deal.
Humiliating, but it's anything but making America great again to be the sole nation on Earth that does not recognize the human contribution to global warming and does not commit as a matter of treaty obligation. And it's the one issue that has brought all nations together.
As for climate change, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says it's happening, but she doesn't blame human activity.
There's no question that the climate changes. And, you know, our state of Wyoming, clearly we wouldn't have the resources we have. We wouldn't have coal, for example, if the climate hadn't changed significantly. That's, you know, the source of all fossil fuels.
The U.S. military has called climate change a national security threat because some U.S. bases are at risk of flooding, while they'll also be tasked with doing more humanitarian missions in countries impacted by rising seas. But Cheney doesn't want to spend money on combating what the federal government says is causing the problem, namely human activity.
We need to be focused on lethality for the military. We need to be focused on making sure that they have the very best, that we've modernized, that they've got the resources they need to defend us, not in particular on, you know, renewable energy standards, for example.
The EPA's Scott Pruitt has received a lot of flack for what critics say is gutting the agency. But over at the Department of Energy, Secretary Rick Perry is working to rewrite the government's stance on coal. He's trying to reward coal and nuclear power because he says they're stable resources of energy during, say, a flood or an ice storm. But even some Republicans, like Pennsylvania's Ryan Costello, say the administration is going backwards in terms of energy policy.
Why are we trying to apply an energy policy that might have made sense 20 years ago and retrofit it now? We're trying to retrofit yesterday into today. That doesn't make sense to me. And so I think there's probably even a larger story on as it relates to energy policy with what he's trying to do than with what Pruitt's trying to do.
But Cheney agrees with Perry, Pruitt, and the Trump White House.
Coal is certainly going to be part of the mix for a very long time to come, and we ought to. It's one of the things we've been working hardest on since the president was elected and sworn in, and since we've been here, is making sure that the playing field's level. That, you know, we're getting rid of the regulations that were really targeted at killing the coal industry.
While it may be a new day for coal and other fossil fuels in the U.S., Democrats and environmentalists fear it's also a new day for the U.S. on the global stage. That's why they're begging Republicans to read the federal government's very own climate assessment and to act on that, not just what's become party orthodoxy. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen is the former Prime Minister of Denmark and, more importantly, the former Secretary General of NATO. Rasmussen made his first trip to Wyoming this week discussing the topic of America's will to lead or perhaps not lead when it comes to world affairs. Rasmussen thinks it's essential to return to being the world's leader. I asked him what he thought about the Trump administration's approach.
Well, of course, we are concerned about what I would call retreat and retrenchment of the United States. But actually, it started already during the Obama administration. So I would say George W. Bush was the last president who was a fully fledged supporter of the strategy that has been pursued by the United States since the Second World War. Then Obama, in opposition to George W. Bush, started what I would call an isolationist course, which has been fully fledged, rolled out by President Trump. So that's a major concern.
I know you spend time talking to other politicians in the United States, and so I'm wondering what you're hearing about that. Do you see this really as the view of the country, or do you take some of what Congress is telling you and some of what the president's telling you?
Well, I take some comfort in the bipartisan support in Congress for a more traditional, a more classical American foreign policy, which has as one of its cornerstone determined American global leadership. So that's what I meet when I meet with members of Congress from both parties. However, I feel when I'm traveling around in the United States that many Americans are actually reluctant to accept this global role of the United States. So for me, coming from Europe, it is a challenge in itself to convince the American people that it is in your own interest to be the global leaders.
Does the president, though, have a point, and some of the people you talk to have a point when they think that the United States over the years maybe had to take on too much?
Well, often America is criticized when it leads from the front. But when it leads from behind, or if the United States doesn't lead at all, the alternative is much worse. So, in my opinion, I don't think the U.S. has done too much. And actually, right now, I think America is doing too little. We should always recall that while action has a cost, inaction might be much more costly, and I'm afraid that Syria is a tragic example of the costs of inaction. 400,000 people killed, more than 10 million people displaced. So I think if the international community had acted much earlier, then we could have prevented that catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. Do you see similar things like that possibly coming down the line if we continue some of this inaction and I guess some of this pushing back against the international community?
Well, I do believe that a continuation of American reluctance to engage will really put the world on fire. Already now we see how the Middle East is torn up by war, how terrorists have spread. We see a failed state in Libya. We see Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine, China flexing its muscles in South China Sea. We see the rogue state, North Korea. Already now, we see all these examples. So we need, I would say it in a very blunt way, we need a global policeman to restore international law and order. And I don't see any other candidate to act as the world's policeman than the United States.
Do you see the United States doing that anytime soon?
I think President Trump will realize, like all his predecessors, that as the president of the United States, you cannot just retreat. If you don't go overseas to take on your enemies overseas, then they will strike you on your own soil. We saw that 9/11, and it is in the United States' own interest to uphold the world order. So I think that fact will also need to be realized by President Trump.
Do you get some comfort that maybe that might happen? He has spent some time overseas. He is starting to meet with more leaders. And maybe you're starting to see a little changing of his tune?
Yeah, I think so. Firstly, he has appointed a security team, which is quite reasonable. They have the right approach, in my opinion. He also actually acted when President Assad crossed one of the red lines using chemical weapons against his own people. He has stated recently that He feels strongly committed to Article 5 in NATO, that is the commitment to defend each other if necessary. And his approach towards North Korea is, in my opinion, the right one. So I think gradually he will change his attitude because he has to.
Can I just follow up on that? His approach to North Korea is the right one. I imagine you mean the diplomatic side of things, not him taunting the leader.
Yeah, well, I think the key to solving the North Korean problem is and remains China. China is the only nation on earth having the sufficient economic and military leverage to really put pressure on Kim Jong-un. But I think a combination of more economic pressure from China and military pressure from the United States is the right way forward.
Very interesting conversation, Anders Fogh Rasmussen. Thank you for coming to join us and welcome to Wyoming.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll talk with Wyoming Senator Dave Kinsky about how to get more bang for our education buck and the mixed reaction to the Trump administration's sage-grouse approach. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. For the last 8 months, a legislative committee has been trying to wrap their heads around the true cost of K-12 education. Senator Dave Kinsky is part of that effort, and he's become well known for saying that he wants to see the most bang for the buck. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson visited Kinsky in Sheridan to ask him what that means.
The United States has been struggling for decades with the question of how do we get better educational attainment. And part of that research started in the 80s, which found when you control for all other variables, socioeconomic status, income, and so forth, the most powerful predictor of student attainment is effective teaching. And since then, there's been a lot of research on what goes into effective teaching. And so, yes, there is a certain amount of art, but there's also a lot of science that can be applied. And the elements are this. First, that you have to be data-driven. Now people go, oh, you just mean teaching to the test. Well, no. When I was in school, you'd have a pop quiz on Monday and then a pop quiz on Friday to see what you'd learned. That's all they're talking about is being data-driven. Have you learned? We've spent a week or 2 weeks studying this particular model. Have you learned? Second is that data is looked at in a transparent way in a collaborative community of teachers. And now that's important because there was other research done that showed in the United States, the difference in educational attainment between schools, the variation is 30%. Within schools, it's 70%. What does that mean? It means within any one school, there are some teachers that are really able to be effective, and there are some teachers struggling a little bit. So what the model does, a collaborative data-driven model, is it says, we're going to sit down together and look at our data results, and the most effective teachers can help mentor and teach the least effective teachers so that the least effective teachers can become more effective. That is the fastest path to progress.
We're seeing results based on that model here in Sheridan.
The consultants that the state has hired over the years observed that the highest performing districts adopted that type of model.
So from the perspective of a policymaker, you are concerned about quality education being available to all students in Wyoming, and you want that bang for the buck. You want to make sure that the dollars that are spent impactfully. So when you see a best practice and you know that not every district in the state is adopting it, what options do you have at the state level in terms of saying, hey, maybe we should adopt this statewide?
Well, I'll tell you, when you float the idea of Cheyenne telling each district what their educational model is going to be, you get rebuffed pretty quickly. That's not just the way people in Wyoming are hooked up. You ask me about my journey as I've studied and learned, I've kind of concluded that It has to come from the school board and the administrators saying, we want to adopt the best practices that we can.
And, you know, we're having conversations about best practices and innovations, but at a time when we're facing big decisions about budget and funding for education. And I'm wondering, you know, how do we reconcile the fact that we might be cutting funds for public education with a conversation about what's most innovative and what the best practices are?
Well, so is it necessary to spend more money than any other state in order to adopt the best practices? Is it the money or is it the management? Is it the legislature's not spending enough, or is it maybe superintendents aren't adopting the best practices? You know, our model in Wyoming is that that money goes out to those districts in a block grant, and it's up to the board and the superintendents to decide how to spend it. And so I guess I'd put the question back to them. How are you going to move to the most effective and best practices in a time of constrained budgets? That's for them to answer.
Really, that's the answer, that we can't send a message from Cheyenne that we see how to do this well and you got to do it that way because it's good for kids?
Well, it could be. Tennessee, I've been wrong before and I'll be wrong again. I just, the way I read the political tea leaves, I don't think there's a whole lot of will down there for mandating how districts are to be running and whether they're going to adopt the best management practices. Sounds crazy, I know, but I think that's just where the politics are. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why superintendents and districts took this money and didn't adopt the best management practices. I don't know why that we're still looking at business as usual in too many districts.
And on this idea of mandates,
you know,
from...
You think it sounds easy just to say the legislature is going to mandate something, but that is not an easy thing.
But it also sounds easy to say, superintendents, we gave you a model and funding, and why didn't you do it that way?
I think the legislature has to take some responsibility, but I'm telling you politically, I think the legislature will stop short of mandating to every district that they adopt the best practices that you're seeing in the best performing districts. I just don't see that happening in Wyoming.
Is it an idea that you've floated, even though you feel like there isn't the political will?
Oh, you lay it out there just to see what the reaction is, but I myself don't know that I'd be prepared to vote for that because I think these things are best not in a top-down direction, but coming from the grassroots.
That was State Senator Dave Kinski speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson. Kinski says the top-performing schools in Wyoming use a model called professional learning communities. In a future story, we'll visit several of those schools to learn what makes them so unique.
Changes are coming to the 2015 sage-grouse management plans. The amendments are giving some businesses hope, but as Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports, others are worried it could unravel a decade of negotiation and compromise.
On an overcast day, an old golden retriever named Ruby walks around the edge of a warehouse in Casper. The large room is filled with tall stacks of boxes filled with rock, some of which have traces of gold. Tim Brown walks over to it, and Ruby is chasing after him.
This is from our project site in the Rattlesnake Hills.
Brown is vice president of exploration for GFG Resources, a junior gold exploration company. The Rattlesnake Hills is a unique geologic area located near the center of Wyoming. That's their project site. Brown says his company is looking to expand the underground zones where traces of gold have already been found. But certain times of year, the company isn't able to work out there at all.
That probably 90 or 95% of that is limited by the sage-grouse restrictions. What that means is we can't do any mechanized activity out there from March 15th to June 30th.
That's mating season for the species. Brown and others at GFG Resources were happy to see the Department of Interior announce upcoming changes to the 2015 sage-grouse management plans. The federal agency began that process last month, saying they would look at amending some or all of the land use plans. Brown knows what he would want with an amendment.
The part that would be nice to see change is if that window were expanded. We want to get as much done in the summertime as we can, and if we could have some relief there, well, that would be a big help.
But what helps him won't necessarily be helpful for the struggling sage-grouse. Once numbered in the millions, the rangeland birds' populations have dropped to below 500,000. The 2015 sage-grouse management plans were seen by many as a huge accomplishment for collaboration and compromise, while maintaining state power. It was a way to keep sage-grouse from being listed as endangered. Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke says he hopes to improve the plan and place a higher priority on economic growth over conservation. This falls in line with a directive issued by President Trump last March, formally prioritizing energy development. Since then, conservation groups across the country have denounced the Secretary's actions as undermining years of collaboration. Those groups include the Sierra Club, Center for Biological Diversity, and the Audubon Society, among others. But it's not just environmentalists who are resisting these changes. Governor Matt Mead and Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper have repeatedly said wholesale changes would threaten the integrity of the plans. One industry happy to see the plan reopening is oil and gas. Under current plans, drilling is restricted in priority areas for sage grouse and limited in others. Diamond Oil and Gas's Deemer True worked for years to get management where it is today as a member of Wyoming's sage grouse implementation team. But even after those years of work, he's glad to see changes. He says there's too many inconsistencies between state and federal rules, and that's slowed down companies' drilling activities.
If they can bring the regional management plans into conformity with the Wyoming State Executive Order, that will bring certainty to the industry, and that would be very helpful.
Drew says that's important because a strong energy industry helps pay the state's taxes. Still, he would not be interested in a plan overhaul. Executive Vice President of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association, Jim McGagna, is another who wants to see some amendments made.
We welcome very much the opportunity to look at some changes.
That's an advocacy group for the livestock industry. McGagna says, left as is, the plans have a high potential to destabilize the ranching industry. He points to the permitting process. That soon, sage grouse considerations will hold too much weight over a rancher's ability to permit on public lands.
And grazing, like all uses of our public lands, needs to be based on a balance and looking at a wide variety of factors, not strictly on the needs of one individual species.
McGagna says, like True, he doesn't want to see the DOI throw out the plans either.
We think that they have a role that they can play if they're properly structured, but they simply went overboard.
Many seem to agree an overhaul of the sage grass management plans would not benefit anyone. But some also see risk in making any changes at all. Tom Christensen is a sage grass program coordinator for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department.
The idea of reopening, it's somewhat akin to ripping a Band-Aid off of a wound, and potential there is for an infection.
Christensen has been involved in sage grass management since the beginning, back in 2000. When he first started, the bird was close to extinction, and he's seen the efforts working, and sage grouse start to come back. In the end, Christensen just hopes any amendments won't remove the fangs from the plants, because they have helped the bird.
If the door gets completely opened to wholesale development on the scale that has been shown by science not to be sustainable for sage grouse, well, that's not going to be a good thing, and could potentially, down the road, lead to a listing, which is not in anyone's best interest.
There's a public comment period open until November 27th. With no concrete changes yet announced, the Interior Department added they're open to large, small, or no changes to the sage grouse plans. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Seven grizzlies have been shot and killed by hunters in Wyoming since the state took over grizzly bear management. That compares to two grizzlies killed last fall. Four grizzlies were killed in Park County alone this year, including one that Game and Fish put down after it was shot. And four people were injured in bear attacks. The question is how those conflicts can be reduced. Penny Preston reports that experts say preparation is key.
Boulder Basin outfitter Carl Sauerwine describes what happened when a grizzly mauled his guide and client this October as they field-dressed an elk south of Cody.
That quick, split second, that he was on them and basically, you know, mauled the both of them. Got a hold of the client first, and then Jonathan rushed in with his knife, apparently, and stabbed the bear in the neck. Just to get it off the clients. The woman had lacerations on her leg that was very close to the femoral artery. Jonathan, when he jumped on the bear, it bit his arm, broken leg, and then puncture wounds and that in his neck, head, back, abdomen area.
The injured hunter and guide were life-flighted to Idaho and Montana hospitals. Both survived. Wyoming's Game and Fish says the grizzly took one of the elk's hindquarters and left the area. I live in grizzly country 6 months of the year with my husband, so we know to watch out for grizzlies, and grizzly tracks are scat every time we go outside. I choose to carry bear spray. Why? Because in 1998, when we first moved to Northwest Wyoming, I went to a Cody gun store to buy a bear gun, a .44 Magnum pistol. The clerk told me he would sell me the gun after I bought bear spray. I asked why, and he said, unless you're lucky enough to hit a bear in the top of its skull while it's charging you, even if you shoot it in the heart and kill it, it will live long enough to kill you. My husband, Dr. Charles Preston, does golden eagle research in grizzly country. He's seen the tracks in the Bighorn Basin for years.
It's a firearm culture where I grew up and here in Wyoming as well, where people are comfortable. From the time I was 7, 8 years old, I learned to hunt and own and use firearms.
So Preston says some people just don't trust bear spray.
So what I hear from a lot of people is, well, you know, I'm comfortable with my firearm. I don't know about this bear spray.
But Preston says studies show you are much safer shooting bear spray at a charging grizzly than shooting a gun.
Where the person being attacked used bear spray, more than 90% of those folks escaped unscathed.
Preston says those studies show there were a few injuries, but no fatalities when people used bear spray.
Using firearms to fend off an attack, with a long gun, it's about a little over 70% effective. And with a handgun, it's about 84% effective in the studies.
Dan White is a bow hunter. A grizzly charged him on a hunt in 2013.
But somewhere around 12 or 15 yards, I started spraying, and I just saw the orange cloud come up, and the bear came through the cloud, and I fell back against the hillside. He was about a foot away from me, and I saw his mouth just turn orange with the spray. And the things I remember, how small his eyes were and how big his teeth were, and he never touched me.
White says the bear turned and ran.
And that bear was still running 400 yards away, full speed.
White supported delisting and hopes to hunt grizzly someday. But he says,
just Google BYU bear study and the data is all there, but it works better and it doesn't kill the bear, and you're much less apt to get injured yourself with bear spray than you are with a firearm.
Wyoming Chief Game Warden Brian Nesvik says it's not always so easy.
Bear spray is not effective at all if there is high winds or there's winds that are in the direction of a hunter. We encourage folks to, number one, this is probably most important, to have a tool that they're comfortable using to defend themselves if they're hunting, recreating, working, running cattle, whatever they're doing in bear country. We encourage them to carry a tool that they're comfortable and competent in using.
Wyoming's Game and Fish Department, with funding from hunting groups, including a bear hunting organization, has given hunters hundreds of cans of bear spray in 3 years. Wyoming is now responsible for managing grizzlies, and as a result, Nesvik says most of the 7 cases of bears being shot by hunters are being investigated. If it is determined the hunter wasn't acting in self-defense and the bear was killed illegally, Nesvik says there can be consequences.
Under state law, those penalties are a maximum of a $10,000 fine, up to a year in jail, and a loss of hunting and fishing privileges.
Nesvik says the best way to reduce conflicts with grizzlies happens before the hunt.
Things that people in Park County have done are a lot of the reason why we have recovered grizzly bears. You know, I look at like the carcass removal program that the county and that the Game and Fish and that the local community has taken on to remove carcasses from ranches. I mean, that's leadership. I mean, that's trying to prevent conflict. And then, you know, a lot of folks have really gotten the message on good practices with food storage.
Nesvik adds that hikers are bear aware, as are most hunters. He says the goal is to find ways to avoid a conflict with a grizzly. From Cody, I'm Penny Preston reporting for Wyoming Public Radio.
When we come back, we'll talk with a University of Wyoming student who survived a hurricane. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. In early September, the Virgin Islands were struck by two Category 5 hurricanes, 14 days apart. Today, the island's infrastructure remains badly damaged. Nearly 73% of residents are still without power. A student from the University of Wyoming was in the Virgin Islands when Irma, the first of the two hurricanes, hit. Sarah Kirkpatrick was spending a semester abroad on the island of St. Thomas. She'd only been there for a few weeks when she heard about the hurricane's approach. Unable to leave the island, she was forced to weather the storm. Travis, a local classmate, offered to shelter Sarah at his family's house.
They were pretty prepared. Like, they had this little bunker kind of area, and he's like, yeah, you can come stay with us. It was basically a living room, a kitchen, a bathroom, and then his room. We found out that it was a Category 5 on Tuesday, and that's when we were like, okay, here we go. They had a lot of stuff outside, so we had, like, to put all of their porch furniture, like, into the pool. We sunk it so it wouldn't, like, blow away or anything, and we had to move, like, anything that was loose. And they had three different kayaks that we had to fill up with water and, like, tie them down to make sure they wouldn't go anywhere. And we also had to put all the shutters down, too. So all of their windows, they, like, had this rolly thing. And, like, it brought down this, like, giant metal things that would cover all the windows.
Altogether, 9 people and the family dog were staying at Travis's house. On Wednesday, everyone rose early and went to the bunker after breakfast. The local power company turned off the electricity in anticipation of the storm.
The room was very hot and smelly. The storm, like, really hit probably around 1 o'clock or 2, and we didn't end up, like, opening the doors again until probably, like, 6. You could hear it outside. It was really loud. It sounded like a constant rushing sound. The wind was so bad at one point that the one door that we had open to, like, get in and out from outside, it was kind of like this metal door, but there was, like, a little space in between it. So, like, it was shaking so hard that, like, we thought it was going to get sucked open just from, like, the force of the wind. And then the guys, they're working on it. They're, like, trying to, like, strap it up and, like, hook it to this dresser inside the room to, like, keep it closed. And I'm over here, like, trying not to pay attention because I know, like, if I just keep watching, I'm just going to get freaked out. I think the only time that I was actually scared was when the door was doing that thing with the shaking. And then there was also another window that they had boarded up with plywood. I didn't see it, but, like, the way that his mom explained it was, like, you saw it start to shake. And she had nailed this plywood into, like, the window, and it just flew off.
After the storm passed, residents without a FEMA pass were not allowed to leave their houses for 5 days. When Sarah finally saw the rest of the island, she was stunned by the damage.
There were down power lines. One house was just gone. Like, it wasn't there anymore. It was just rubble. There was one church where the front-facing wall was just completely caved in. Like, you could see into the church from the road. And it's that kind of stuff that, like, you realize how long it's going to take to fix. The next thing was the lines of people. So, like, we pass the gas station and there's just a line down the street of people waiting to get gas. And it was hot that day. Like, the day that we had left, they had, like, a huge line for water too. Like, it was just crazy to see that many people just waiting.
Sarah spent several days trying to find a way home. St. Thomas's airport was badly damaged in the storm, and her flight kept getting delayed. Finally, she heard that a ferry was taking people to St. Croix, an island that had suffered less damage. She joined a group of classmates on a campus shuttle to the ferry.
So campus security, they had told them the wrong location of where the ferry was leaving. So they drove us all the way across the island, and then there was no ferry there. And we had to drive back to try to catch this boat. So I thought I was missing my boat, like, out of here. I was freaking out. All the other students were kind of like, oh my gosh, we're not going to make it. And it's pouring rain, and there are these giant puddles in the road that, like, we're trying to, like, swerve around so we don't end up, like, getting stuck in the water. And by some miracle, we make the boat ride. So we're headed over to St. Croix, and then my flight out of there happened without incident.
She caught a flight from St. Croix to San Juan, and from San Juan to Denver. Sarah is glad to be back at UW, but leaving St. Thomas was bittersweet.
I feel bad because the first people who were off the island were tourists. They got on cruise ships and, like, they were taken care of right away. Whereas the people who live there, they have to stay there. There's nowhere else for them to go. And I was lucky enough to have a place to, like, go home to.
Her semester abroad didn't go as planned, but she doesn't regret going.
It's obviously, like, a horrible thing to have happen, but at the same time, it's an experience that I wouldn't want to, like, do differently. It was just a reminder of, like, you have a plan for your life, and then when the plan can suddenly go out the window, like, you just have to kind of go with it.
Sarah Kirkpatrick is the daughter of our program director, Grady Kirkpatrick. That story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's August Law.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed this program or want to hear an individual segment again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Anna Rader is our web editor.
You can also use that website to sign up for our podcast. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.